Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 156 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell. Alongside me, Johnny Stofko.
What's up, TK? What's up, everybody? Episode 156, who we got?
Man, we've got an absolute legend in terms of... I don't think anyone's doing it to this his degree. Like, Dr. Stuart McGill is who I'm speaking about. But it's an interesting topic because the back, it's something that you can't just put a cast on.
Yeah, man. And it's one of these things, you know, as a coach yourself, myself included, how common is it? Like, the back injury.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things, like you said, you can't put a cast on it. And usually clients will come to us with pre-existing back injuries.
Yeah.
And they're never specific. Like, think about your clients. It's never like, oh, they have a lower back problem, but I know exactly what it is. And I know how it exactly happened. It's never the case.
Oh, it's just such a delicate area. And it just seems that in the mainstream, there's so much advice coming from everywhere.
Left, right.
That people just don't know what advice to actually take. So I think it's a great chance for us to actually bring on an expert, a proven expert in the field, someone that our peers really respect. I think that's a huge thing in this area. The fact that we've got a lot of people in our inner circle that go straight, this is Jim McGill, is the shit. He's the man in this area.
When you go to your Facebook, when you go to your personal Facebook page and you see the mutual friends, Joe DeFranco, Jason Ferrugia, Cameron Joss, he's been in the game 40 plus years. He's a researcher. He's a student. He's a coach. He's a teacher. And this is why I love the show we do, because we get to share space with a guy like this who then gets to share with everyone listening.
Definitely. Before we get Stu on, guys, a big thank you for tuning into the show, subscribing and leaving us those awesome reviews on iTunes.
5-star reviews, guys. iPhone users, go to iTunes right now. Subscribe to the show. Android, SoundCloud, it takes 2 seconds.
Definitely. Best thing for us is if you can share it with your family and friends. It just helps us to bring the message out. Like, I think Stu's going to bring some absolute knowledge bombs that I think a lot of people need to hear.
Yeah.
And it's just advice that you can apply to your everyday life. Because when you think about it, you know, before the show started, I was telling you about my own problems with my lower back for the last couple of weeks.
Yep.
And I know from just having sat down with Stu and yourself that I've got a couple of little things that I know that I can bring home tonight that I think will definitely help that area.
1,000,000%. Dr. Stuart McGill, this is one of those episodes, while you and I are interviewing him, it's one of those rare ones that when he's talking about stretches to do or assessments, we're actually like, thank God we're not doing these videos, because we're actually like in the interview doing them and taking notes. And, you know, you always say, get your pen and paper out, because coaches out there, clients out there listening who have coaches, this guy is like the pinnacle of the expertise of the spinal, the back, the pain. So we're stoked.
Yeah, definitely, guys. At the end of the episode, the actual fire alarm goes off. So in terms of getting in contact with Stu, we're going to have that all in the show notes. So definitely check it out on our website, www.thevisionboardpodcast.com, because I think Stu's definitely someone that you want to continue to follow, because the stuff that he does on Facebook and a few of his YouTube videos, definitely, like I said, something you can apply to your everyday life.
Yeah, couldn't say it better, man. He works with so many high-level elite athletes, he can't even name names.
Yeah, for sure. Think about that. Yeah, that was interesting. Mm. All right, guys, without further ado, I introduce Dr. Stuart McGill. Our special guest is Dr. Stuart McGill. Stuart is a professor of spine biomechanics at the University of Waterloo in Canada. He has a PhD and master's in biomechanics from the same university, and also Ottawa, and a BPHE from the University of Toronto. He's one of the most highly regarded and sought after experts in spine biomechanics, and is a consultant to the elite athletes, sports teams, legal experts, corporations, and the government. We welcome Dr. Stuart McGill. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tristan and Johnny.
Stuart, we appreciate you stopping by the Vision Board. I'd like to take this time real quick to thank you for sharing this space with us. So we know, Tristan and I know, that you've been a professor for over 30 years. Your resume speaks for itself. Could you share with our listeners and our fans a little bit about what's going on in the life of Stuart McGill currently in your career?
Well, as of last Christmas, I retired from the university where I was a professor for 32 years. Mm. Our objectives of my time there in the research lab and clinic was to work to probe the spine and figure out how it worked and then how it became injured and how did that lead to pain. And the third element was how to rehabilitate it and restore optimal function. I started out obviously trained as a scientist, but morphed into this clinician as different clinical groups would ask me to work with their patients. And we soon realized that our approach, unpolluted by traditional medical views and teaching, really provided insights into people having difficult times with their backs. So that was the start of us turning into clinicians. So we ran the research clinic there for quite a number of years as well. And as you probably know, patients would fly in really from around the world. And some of them were very high-profile athletes, and others just had very difficult times with their backs.
Stu, could you...
Anyway, that was my time at the university. And now I just see very challenging backs and continue my consulting with the different sports groups and teaching clinical groups when they ask.
Stu, recently I was reading an article on ways to decompress the spine, and they were the gentleman who wrote the article was talking about that as we evolved as bipedalists, we're not necessarily suited to be upright. The article is almost written that it's almost healthier for us to be walking on like all fours, that sort of thing. What's some insight on that, and does this have any relation to a lot of the spinal cord issues that we have as humans?
Well, I really don't think about that because there's nothing we can do about it. Now, that might sound like a trite answer, and I've heard people say, well, we have great difficulty. I look at it the opposite way. I think we have tremendous abilities. We've had some of our lifters after injury set world records in squat and deadlift, squatting over 1,000 pounds. I mean, that's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. And to look at the sprinters who can then pull tremendous speed out of their bodies, and then the dancers who can produce tremendous mobility, the golfers, I think the system is doing quite well. The problem lies when people don't respect biological tipping points, and they get a bit rammy, I suppose. And as every single biological system does, if you cross the tipping point, it succumbs either through injury or sickness. But if you're under the tipping point, you keep building this wonderful system. So I don't even think along those lines that our problems are because we're bipedal. I look at the wonderful advantages.
Yeah. Stu, after 30 years, you know, you just mentioned that you retired from the university, but, you know, you're still working with a lot of athletes. Like, is there anything in particular that really tickles your fancies in terms of a particular sport? I know that at this stage of your career, you must want to focus.
Not really. What tickles my fancy, to use that euphemism, is tuning body. So to pull pain-free performance out of a body, just like you're building a racing car, you have to tune it. So if you add a little bit of horsepower, you're probably going to have to stiffen the suspension, change the gearing in the transmission, etc. So we do exactly that in pulling out human performance. I hear strength coaches quite often say, being stronger is better. Well, I think they should measure some of the greatest athletes, and they will find they might have sufficient strength, but their speed, their mobility, et cetera, comes from the ability and speed of relaxation, for example. If you were to measure who hits the hardest in the UFC, it's not the guys with the biggest muscles. Yeah. They tend to push their punches. It's the guys who can start off with that muscular pulse, release into relaxation, create a very high closing velocity, and then a stiffening pulse at the end with the full core, arm, full linkage becoming stiff. So there's an example of tuning the body for optimal performance. But when you say, do I have a particular sport, there are some sports that I find to be the ultimate challenge. As you are no doubt aware, in pulling performance, you can't have it always. You can't be really mobile and then bear heavy loads. There's a blend of stability, mobility. You can't have a very high VO2 max for endurance and then be an explosive athlete. They're two completely different metabolisms that you adapt. So to answer your question, I would have to say the MMA athletes need endurance and explosive power. Yeah. So that's a trade-off. They need supreme stability and supreme mobility. That's a trade-off. They need to be extremely endurable. It really is for someone trying to tune that body. And as you know, everyone who comes to me, they only come because they have an underlying back issue.
Yeah.
That probably is one of the greatest challenges versus, say, a golfer who is much more unidimensional in the demands on their body. They don't need to lift heavy weights. They don't need to be endurable. They don't need to be a lot of things, but the things that they do need, they need with a high level. So it's a little easier to tune that particular athlete. But anyway, there's a probably too long-winded an answer for your question.
No, that was a great answer. Stu, me and Johnny are both huge MMA fans as well and boxing fans. And I was really interested with that video you put on Facebook with your studies with the other gentleman, the strength and conditioning coach, really breaking down that movement in terms of, like you just did mention, you know, increasing, well, you guys found which athlete in terms of muscle bound versus slimmer who would create the most force in that actual punch. In terms of that, what you actually found from that study, have you been able to coach that into any MMA fighters currently?
Oh, very much so.
And it's because a lot of these guys have been fighting since they were like little kids. So to make them change, it must be like a huge mission, right?
No. First of all, there's a great natural selection process. So if a little kid can't hit very hard, he's going to go find another sport. It's no fun repeatedly going to the hospital. But I'm going to tell you a story that you may appreciate.
So,
Bruce Lee, as you may or may not know, really had some very interesting writings about enhancing human performance. And he wrote a piece back in the 70s about the kettlebell swing. And he would swing the kettlebell, which was a homemade kettle because no one really knew what a kettlebell was in those days. But he would swing it in a very relaxed way. But then as the kettle swung through until the arm was level and the hand was out in front, he would put a pulse, a kime pulse, as it was known, as the arm just came to horizontal. And that pulse was sharp on, sharp off. And then he relaxed again and then went through the swing. So there's an example of someone getting a beautiful relaxation and then the pulse at hardening in strike position. So that was his training technique to create a stiffer pulse. And he described it as I relax to gain speed until the instant my fist reaches the target, and then I put my mind and body into that fist. And what he meant by that was at that point, he put in a pulse of stiffness. So he didn't hit a person with the weight of his hand or his arm. He actually hit them with 160 pounds of stone, because that was what he had trained at that time. And you'll find the guys who kick the hardest, punch the hardest, actually have less torsion in their torso, but they have more hip turn and a stiffer core on impact. And that is what created what eventually became known as the one-inch punch. So I can tell all kinds of stories that we've measured and documented and formed the foundation for some of the training that we might do. But I will say this as well. I just gave you an example that came from someone as brilliant as Bruce Lee. Now, there are lots of brilliant coaches, and there are absolutely masterful athletes. They don't know what it is they do to create the performance, because no one has ever measured it or documented it. So I suppose that that was our little contribution to try and understand the mechanisms of how they did this with injury resiliency and that kind of thing. So we were able to explain it and then understand better training regimens to create whatever that particular athleticism was.
Stu, sticking to the performance athletes, specifically mixed martial arts, specifically jiu-jitsu, actually. One of my buddies fights in the UFC, and that lower spinal cord injury, L4, L5, it happens quite often when they're rolling. And recently, in the last few years, I heard a gentleman, are you familiar with Louis Simmons at Westside Barbell?
Of course you are.
So I need your insight, man, on the reverse hyper, because some guys are standing on that platform saying that it works. It's like a godsend. You don't need surgery. Get the reverse hyper and it'll alleviate that spinal, you know, that pressure and help the spine. And some guys are saying, you know, this guy's not a doctor. It's reckless to, you know, prescribe the reverse hyper for lower spinal cord injuries. What's your take on that?
Well, the answer on that one is, like everything, it depends. If it's not a spinal cord injury, by the way, usually people who do not tolerate the reverse hyper have either a disc bulge or joint instability. And to define that very precisely, they have micro movements at the joint that are triggering pain with the movement. Now I know Louis's explanation of the reverse hyper is that it pumps blood into the area and that kind of thing. That's not what we've measured. The discs are avascular, but it is quite effective at building strength. Now, it also requires a lot of spine bending. So now this is driven by the assessment. If the person has a proper assessment of their pain triggers, they will know very precisely the motions, postures, and loads that exacerbate their pain. Conversely, they will also know those that are tolerable. So now they're able to make better decisions on training. For example, a kettlebell swing where all of the motion is about the hip and a hip hinge, that might be very tolerable for them if they tolerate shear load and compression, but they don't tolerate bending. So that would be a decision. But if they don't tolerate shear load, I would not give them a kettlebell swing, because a kettlebell swing, as you bring the kettle through to where the arm is outstretched and horizontal, there's a shear load on the spine that for some very strong backs, that's the one thing that will tweak their back pain. And yet others are quite resilient to it. So I hope that gives you, it depends answer. It depends on the assessment. Do you want me to give you a little algorithm on how you choose exercise or how we do?
Yes, because we really appreciate that. So you're saying, though, before we get there, that with that assessment, it's strictly up to the individual who has the injury to decide if it's right for them. Is that
well, I mean, an educated decision, of course, and they will probably require some expertise to help them with the assessment, and then how to execute the exercise. For example, if you lay across the, to be precise now, do you mean a glute ham raise or do you mean in a reverse hyper? Louie, I think, was more on the glute ham raise, where the upper body is laid across the plat, the pad, and the hip, there's a belt that goes around lower.
That's it.
So that's a glute ham raise. That's sort of what I thought you were talking about. But anyway, nonetheless, here's a general algorithm that will help you determine the most effective exercise to reach the goal. So the first stage is we define what is required for success. So we could take powerlifting, we could take MMA, we could take golf. What we would do is write down on the page the requirements for success. So if it was a deadlift that was required, you would say, all right, you need grip strength. You need the mobility to get down there to reach the bar, but no more. You want to be at full elastic extension in the tissues when you reach the bar. So you're going to tune that. You're going to need compressive load-bearing ability. You have to balance through the feet. You get the idea. You would list in those parameters what's required. Then go measure the person to see if they have those variables. If they don't, those are the things that will provide the greatest benefit if you train them. So now you look at the mismatches. What do they need? What do they not have? Now go choose the best training tool you can find to train that particular variable. Then you put together your program with appropriate volumes and rest periods for best adaptation, etc. But anyway, so if you say to me, the reverse hyper is the best tool you have for creating that hip extensor power, then fair enough. That's the answer. And is it tolerable for that person's injury and pain history? So that's the general approach for asking at any time, what's the best exercise and what do I think of a particular exercise? It's not that there are fantastic ones and poor ones. It's more a matter of, can you choose the most appropriate training tool to achieve the goal in that particular individual?
Sure, I know you said it depends on the circumstances of different, you know, training methods for different people. But what I see a lot is that as soon as someone gets injured, it could be, for example, they might have maybe a shoulder twinge or something like that, and then they stop training altogether. In terms of getting some advice from you, is can people continue to train when they're injured in specific areas?
Well, of course they can. If you go through the second book I wrote, it's called Ultimate Back Fitness and Performance. That's the big thing. How do you keep the person training? Say you've built tremendous leg strength in a strength athlete, and they've tweaked their back, so they can't tolerate load in their back for a little while. You've got to allow desensitization of the pain to occur. Well, you know, you could get them to walk backwards up a hill, pushing through the knees, really keep their quads going. Then you could tell them, okay, now walk forwards up the hill. Their quads are exhausted. Guess what happens? They have to use their glutes. The motor control system has no other way to do it. Or then you could give them a band, not around the knees, not around the ankles, but around the forefoot. Spread the band and now walk up the hill. And they will find, my goodness, they just preserved all that terrific leg and glute strength that they developed while they found a way to do so unloading their back. So I think quite often it's uncreative trainers and coaches that allow an athlete to languish because they have a back injury or a shoulder injury or a neck injury. And then having said all of that, of course, there are times just to dial back the volume and let the whole system adapt.
Stu, could you share some insight a little bit about, so say we have a client, the client comes to you and they are experiencing a lot of pain. And do you have a specific pattern? Do you start, like say the pain's in the middle of the spine, do you look straight at the middle of the spine or do you start at the foot? Do you start at the ankle? Could you share maybe a quick, for the coaches at home, maybe a quick rough draft version of like an assessment?
Yes, absolutely. I have to say, follow my book, Back Mechanic. What it does is it guides, I really wrote that one for the lay public with back pain. And then to my surprise, physios and coaches said, oh, this is the most consumable book you've written thus far, which I never anticipated. But what we do in starting there is we sit down with the person and we just say, tell us about your back. And that conversation may last half an hour, and they will tell you what makes their back pain worse, what is tolerable, or what might even make their back pain better. They will tell you impediments to training that you may not realize. They reveal all kinds of things, and then you can ask some key questions like, let's see, when you're in bed and you roll over, do you ever get a sharp pain in your back? And if they say yes, that's a very strong indicator that they have joint micro-movements triggering pain. And then we observe their movement habits. How did they get out of the waiting room chair? How did they walk down to the assessment room? Now, I see patients now at my home. And I turn on the fireplace. They come in. I have a specially made, very firm leather couch that they sit on to support their back and hips. I turn on the fire, and that is such a conducive atmosphere for them to really tell me so I get to understand them and their back, and I'm watching them get on and off the couch, bending down to pick up their backpack, how they took off their shoes. In other words, I'm assessing their movement habits. Why is it that they have picked the scab and sensitized their back? And it may simply be that they just continue to pick the scab all day long through poor movement patterns. But I have to know that. All the time while I'm listening and probing, I'm trying to understand things like their learning style. Do they listen to verbally and execute, or do they need a cue from my hand to touch them, or whatever it is? Then we get off the couch, we walk downstairs. Again, I'm watching their movement habits, and then we go formally to the assessment room, where we do provocative testing. We mimic what they just described as causing their pain, and we precisely define it. What are the very specific motions, postures, and loads that get them to be more painful? Then immediately we try and show them, can they do that without mimicking the pain? So I might say, for example, I might say, compress your torso by pulling your shoulders down with your pec and your lat muscles. Now repeat the heel drop test, for example. And they might say, you know, doc, you're amazing. You just took my pain away. So we're getting some quite strong confirmations at this point as to what's causing their pain and what they need to do to take their pain away. And then we'll try coaching an alternate movement. How might they get up and down stairs? How might they bend down to pick up their backpack or even a kettlebell or whatever happens to be? But, I mean, as you probably are aware, I coach people through this self-assessment in Back Mechanic. Yeah. But for clinicians and coaches, I have my big clinical book called Low Back Disorders, and that's the heavy one that takes people through a full formal assessment of their pain triggers. But anyway, that gives you a little bit of a breadth, I suppose. It may surprise you that I book out 3 hours when I set up an assessment.
Wow. Yes, Stu. So if let's play, I'm speaking about a technology that probably isn't around, but maybe it is, and you could fill me in. So say if you develop a five simple question questionnaire for clients, and all the clients, they have a common denominator of back pain. So you have the five questions that you've come up with, and imagine that I have the 10 clients in Australia, in Sydney, at my gym. You're living in Canada, and I do a 10-second video of them just walking, walking towards me, and then walking away. Do the 10-second video, send the five-question questionnaire to you with their answers in the video. Do you think you would be able to identify and help assess that client's pain just from the video and the questions?
Not at the level that I work at, no.
And if, what if there was an app for that, like a digital sort of coach thing, like assessed by an expert like yourself, to where it would help, I think, a lot of personal training?
We've tried that, and I need, you know, what you're sort of talking about is what radiologists do. They look at an algorithm, which is an MRI picture, and they see all these changes, and then they write a report, which is, for back pain, pretty much next to useless, because they never saw the patient to get a context of their history. You don't know whether you're looking at a cause or a consequence. And I would say the same thing when I look at people. Are they moving a certain way because that's what pain has done, and that's their limp because of the pain, or is that what is causing the original pain? And I need to have a lot more information than that. So there are people who say they can do this, but I book out 3 hours, and I use that time to really hone in, to give them good advice. You know, maybe you'll appreciate this. We see all kinds of people, you know, doing a movement screen and then giving out advice to the people. Oh, you can't deep squat. You need more ankle mobility. Wait a second. Probably the most important feature is the depth of their hip socket. You know, come on. It's you can watch movement. There is a multitude of different ways that you can create that movement, given all the redundancy and different muscle patterns, that will create exactly the same movement. So I'm afraid the system is a little bit more interesting than that. And I will just repeat, that's why I spend the time to get a better interpretation. And if I'm going to be the one who makes the difference when another dozen or so clinicians have failed, I need a little bit more precision and information and understanding of pain mechanisms, et cetera.
Yeah. Stu, in terms of size of your hip, what you just spoke about then, in terms of like then translating that into how deep we can squat, is there any way in the time that you've seen with your research that you can predict like the depth that you should be going to on a squat?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell a little story about this. Let's first chase orthopedic disease. So the first hip disease, let's talk about the incidence of hip dysplasia. So if we go across the white nations of Europe, the country with the highest rate of hip dysplasia is Poland. The reason is, on average, not every Pole, but on average, they have a very shallow hip socket. So what that means is the ball can fall out of the socket quite easily, particularly when in younger kids, they have to wear special diapers and all this kind of thing. However, I've also just described a country that produces tremendous Olympic lifters. They have a beautiful deep squat if they have that borderline dysplastic hip. They get wonderful mobility, and they can deep squat with no stress to the hip joint. And then when you measure the power production out of the deep squat, out of the hole, the power is just ungodly. Now, let's go to the other side of Europe, Western Europe, and let's look at the Celtic gene pool, which is Normandy, France, Ireland, and Scotland. They have the highest incidence of FAI, femoral acetabular impingement, which is an orthopedic disease. The reason is they have the deepest hip sockets. So when you measure their deep squat, they don't get down very far, and the femur collides into the front of the hip socket or acetabulum. That's what's causing the impingement and the orthopedic disease. And then you will notice the lumbar spine rounds into inflection because there's no more motion left at the hip joint. So now we've got a situation where, all of a sudden, they've got a lot more back stress. Not only are they getting FAI, but they've got more back stress. Now, again, not every Celt has this very deep hip socket. And then when you measure the mechanics of the squat, they don't have much power out of the hole. Their power is in the top half of the squat. Okay, well, if you're a rugby player, a tennis player, a hockey player, a soccer player, it doesn't matter. You're in an upright standing position anyway, and most of the hip athleticism is in internal-external rotation. But anyway, there's just an example where anatomy determines the tolerance of the joint, the incidence of orthopedic disease, and the athletic advantage. Now, to get at your question, is there a simple test of that? Yes, there is. Go on all fours, put your knees together, and rock your buttocks back to your heels. And you will see where the hips collide and the spine is forced into heavy flexion. Now spread the knees apart and see if you can get deeper into the squat in producing a neutral curve. And you might say, a listener might say, well, what's the problem with flexing the spine? There is no problem in that particular situation. But if you have 300 kilos on your back, now we have a problem. We're stressing the collagen fibers in the discs, and eventually with motion plus compressive load, they will delaminate, and the athlete's going to succumb with a disc bulge. But if they don't have the motion or they don't put on heavy loads, they're going to be okay. But anyway, there's a test and a story of how and why all this matters and is measured.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.divisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Stu, we were talking to Dr. Kelly Starrett, and he was filling us in about, you know, he's about to release his second version of Becoming a Supple Leopard with some revisions to it. So my question goes along the lines of, the stretching aspect before, like powerlifting, before strength training. After we get off this call, I have a few clients. We're going to go squat and deadlift. Is there a specific do and don't prior to warming up in terms of stretching and worrying about the tendons and elasticity and things like that?
Well, of course there is. Are you dealing with a slow strength athlete or a elastic athlete? If you're dealing with an elastic athlete, you don't stretch for more mobility. You stretch to tune the elasticity of storage and recovery of elastic energy. So an example there might be a NBA basketball player who takes two steps, jumps off the heel, not the toes, off the heel from the top of the key, flies through the air and dunks a basketball. That is an elastic athlete. They didn't do a deep squat. They just punched through the heel, created a hammer with the hip into a stone, a core of stone, and they flew through the air. They lose the core of stone. They're pushing rope. They don't jump very far. And if they don't have the hip hammer, they don't jump very far. Now, I'm going to ask you a question.
Yes.
Did Michael Jordan have loose hamstrings?
I would say no.
Absolutely not. If you would go to the NBA All-Star game last year, watch the halftime show. They had some show dunkers there.
Yes.
Guys who were dunking the basketball, just putting on a magnificent show. Oh, I measured. The guy who's known as being one of the best, I've measured his hamstrings. He is so tight, he gets about a 30-degree straight leg raise. And then some coaches have said, oh, son, you better stretch your hamstrings. That's a problem. And I said, don't you listen to those coaches. Don't you go near them. Keep your hamstrings as tight as you can.
Wow.
Because that's the storage and recovery of elastic energy spring that is your gift. And, you know, make sure that when that spring unloads, your core is a stone because you can't push rope. Anyway, there is an example where you don't want any mobility there at all. You want a tuned, stiffened spring. Now we'll get into powerlifting because you told me you're going to go do some deadlifting. Do you want a person that has more mobility that they can go down and touch their toes? Because that's not the best powerlifter in the world. The powerlifter who's the best in the world struggles to get his hands down to the bar because now they've got full elastic tension in their body and what muscular extensor mechanisms they put in are already augmented by the elastic recoil. Now, let's talk about a high tower diver who has to contort their body, get into very tight tucks, to reduce the moment of inertia to get four rotations before they hit the water. They better have a lot of mobility. So you are probably stretching them more to achieve a range of motion. But, you know, I'll give you one more example on this because I've done this several times. You take a world-class marathon runner, a long-distance runner. I remember one who was one of the best long-distance runners of his country. He came with back pain, and he had a bit of an asymmetric hip, so we worked on that as the mechanism. But then I said to him, tell me about the weakest part of your game, because while we're working on your back and hip, if I knew what we needed to enhance while you're doing this, I might make you a better athlete all at the same time. And that's where the magic happens. And he said, well, you know, my first 2 miles are my slowest. And the lights went off in my head immediately. And I said, really? Tell me about your warm-up. Oh, well, I do these runner stretches. I stretch out my Achilles and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, why on earth are you doing that? Because it forces you then to run on muscle. I want you to be a bunny rabbit or a kangaroo and run on the elastic tendons, and you just tune the muscles to better store and recover the elastic energy. And all of a sudden the lights went off on him, and he said, yeah, that's stupid. I don't know why we do that. It's tradition. It's not science. Anyway, I saw him a few months later, a big smile on his face. He says, you know, I just ran the fastest first 2 miles I've ever ran. I didn't do any stretching.
Wow.
And I said, well, you know, so this idea of stretching and mobility, you know, and by the way, Kelly and I, we've shared some professional athletes just to reveal that, you know, so we certainly respect each other's work. There is a time and a place for stretching and mobility, of course, but, you know, this idea that, well, you stretch to get mobility, wait a second, there are some people where I want to tune them to be even tighter. So we will do ricochet exercises and things like this to tighten their bodies. And certainly, you know, years ago, I remember working with Olympians in high jump, and they weren't very good, and they brought in some Russian coaches who took out all that stretching, and they put in stiffening exercises, and all of a sudden they became better high jumpers. So be careful of common perception there.
Yeah, you know, you spoke before about the NBA play with the tight hamstrings and also with the runners as well. In terms of things that complement, complement having that and maybe equalizing that, how much does core strength come into that, Stu?
Well, I wouldn't use the word core strength. I don't think core strength has ever been shown to really be important for making a resilient athlete. But I would certainly say core stability and stiffness. Can I give a little mini story on what stability and core strength is really all about?
Please. Go for it.
Okay, because as you know, there's lots of people who hand wave about core stability, and I don't think they know what they're talking about because they've never measured core stability. You know, they say, oh, this muscle isn't firing and all of that. It's just not on. When you measure core stability, you'll find certain things, and now you will see it is absolutely non-negotiable. There's no question you need a stiffened core to perform. And I'm going to give three stories to show how non-negotiable it is. Number one, you need proximal stability to create distal athleticism. So, you know, a backhoe, like a heavy equipment that digs in the ground,
yeah.
A backhoe puts down stabilizers to lift the back wheels off the ground to lock the machine into the ground so then it can dig with the arm and wrist and pull. Well, that's exactly what a person needs. So consider a uniarticular muscle like the pec major. It crosses the shoulder joint. That is the muscle that you develop by doing bench press exercise. So you might be able to bench 200 kilo, 440 pounds for our American friends. Now, in upright standing, you can only bench press half your body weight and then you fall over. You need a core to underpin the strength. Now let's go back to the pec major that just crosses the shoulder joint. Distal in the arm, it flexes the arm around. But proximal, that same muscle connects the rib cage. So the proximal action of pec major is it bends the whole rib cage towards the shoulder joint. So if I was going to push you and I had a floppy core, my arm would come around and push, but then my torso and ribcage would collapse towards the joint. I'd have a huge energy leak. Very ineffective. Now, if I had core stiffness, I locked down the proximal side of the joint. 100% of that muscle action is then expressed distally. So now you see, to create high force, high squats, speed, you have to have a stiffened core to transmit shoulder and hip power to the distal limbs. That's when the magic happens. I'll give you an example with a child. Say a kid has a paralyzed quadratus lumborum, which is the muscle that runs up the side of the spine. If you watch them walk, you'll notice that they can't put weight on one leg. Say they have a paralyzed left quadratus lumborum. If they're standing on their left leg and swinging the right leg when they're walking, there's no issue. But when they plant the right leg and swing the left, the whole pelvis drops down on that side because core stability and stiffness hasn't held up the pelvic platform, which supports the spine. So you can't even walk without sufficient core stiffness. Anyway, that's the little story on it's non-negotiable. You have to have core stiffness and stability to move and run and walk and cut and punch and all this sort of stuff. The second element of core stability has to do with what's called Euler stability. The spine is not a long rigid bone or a beam. It's a collection of vertebra that are the whole spine is flexible. You can't ask a stack of oranges to bear compressive load. You have to stiffen and stabilize that stack of oranges. Well, your core musculature, the abdominals in the front, the quadratus, the obliques, the psoas laterally, and the whole erector spinae and latissimus complex in the back form the guy wires in the back. So now you've got a guy wire system all around the torso. And when it's appropriately stiffened, it, from an engineering sense, it directs the thrust line right down the spine, and it makes it resilient and able to bear tremendous loads, tons, as a matter of fact. So core stability and stiffness from that coordinated guy wire system, once again, is non-negotiable for bearing heavy load. But if you want to dance and have a mobile spine, you've got to take all the strength out of your spine, all the load out of it, and now you can have the tuned mobility. So those muscles need to do both. Now, the third element that's non-negotiable for core stability has to do when a person has perhaps got a flattened disc or they've damaged a joint in their back, and now they've got little micro movements in the shear mode that's triggering pain. But with appropriate core stiffness, they can create a girdle, which stiffens out the micro movements, and now their pain is gone. And you know, we've restored some pretty high-profile athletic careers who have now incorporated stiffening and stabilizing patterns to engineer out the micro-movements, and they've regained their athleticism. And over time, nature will regristle that joint and stiffen it. But in the meantime, they will have to do it with muscle patterns. Anyway, there are three different physical principles where core stability is non-negotiable. So you see, it's not really a strength issue. The great athletes, when you measure them, have what we call sufficient strength, but more is not necessarily enhancing of their athleticism as long as they have sufficient strength. But they also have this wonderful coordination to appropriately stiffen the core when they need it and to loosen it off when they need to dance and throw a ball or perform that kind of athleticism. But here's an example. Have you ever tried to hit a golf ball far and you try really hard and you'll notice the golf ball doesn't go very far?
Yeah, I do it all the time.
Because when a muscle contracts, it creates both force and it creates stiffness. So if you use too much muscle force when you're swinging a golf club, it actually stiffens and slows you down. So again, there's an example of this marvelous interplay between contracting and pulsing muscle and letting it go to relax and what's required to pull out injury resilience and performance enhancement. But does that give you I hope a fairly insightful understanding of why core stability is not strength, and it's absolutely non-negotiable for performance.
Stu, you've given us so much, everything from the algorithm. One of my favorite things about doing the show is going back and highlighting the key points. I'm going to have to ask you for one more thing, though. For a lot of our fans are coaches, and a lot of we have clients. So with all the fluff in the fitness industry, so many things of like social media, magazines, could you point us as the coach in the right direction in regards to research? Maybe pick one or two sites or one or two places to go to learn the right things to become a better coach.
Yeah, go to my website and read my stuff.
My man.
Yeah, I mean, look, I wrote that. To write a book is a big deal. It takes years to put a good book together. And I wrote my first one for clinicians because we've published well over 300 medical articles now and engineering articles on how this marvelous thing called the spine works and functions. But it was a royal pain for anyone to go and get all the little papers and put them together. So that's why I wrote the first textbook. And then people in the performance world said, well, could you put this in a consumable way? But now tell us about specific exercises that you've measured and why we might choose one. So that is how Ultimate Back Fitness came about. And then back pain people, members of the lay public, people who you are training, would then contact me and said, boy, this is really uniquely insightful what we're reading, but it's pitched at a level way too difficult for us. Could you write a book, simplify it, so that we can use it as the lay public? That was the most difficult book I've written. It took me 5 years. It's not simple, but I have to honor the integrity of how all of this works. So when I first approached a publishing company, they said, this book isn't going to sell. You have to have a title, Fix Your Back in 5 Easy Steps. And I said, but that has no integrity. It's not possible. So the book is actually 17 chapters, and I've made it as simple as I possibly can, still honoring the complexity of all of the different reasons why people have back pain. But I'm sorry. I'm arrogant, I suppose, but I've spent my life trying to put together the best information I can, tune out all the noise and distractions of the internet and Facebook and people's opinions who haven't earned their opinion yet. They spend too much time on Facebook instead of doing their work. I just decided, forget all that, and I will put together what our experience has shown. And you know, we tested it with firefighters, military, different occupational groups, different athletic groups. So we were able to see if it worked or not. And that's where I suggest people go.
All right, Stu, unfortunately, we've run out of time, so we're going to have to organize part two because both myself and Johnny, we've got about 20 questions
I know, man.
At least each to ask you. And it's such interesting work, and the advice you've given us is brilliant. But just one quick thing before you leave. In terms of insights into your own personal day, is there any particular movement yourself that you have to do every single day that you know will enhance your back health?
Absolutely. Do you know much about me or not?
Well, yeah, I've listened to the first time, it was 2 years ago, and a guy that I follow called Jason Ferrugia, I listened to him a lot. He's a big strength coach. He was from Jersey, then he's come over to California. And, you know, if he says something, it does resonate with me that yeah. I do need to check this out.
For sure.
So then, obviously, I started on your website. And
to answer your question, I trained heavy when I was younger. I'm 60 years old now. I've broken my neck, my collarbone, my rib cage, a hip. I've had hip replacement. I mean, you know, I've been through all of this, and I think there's a little bit of content validity of what I'm talking about. And there, my body now will not tolerate me crossing that biological tipping point, and I know where that tipping point is. So every day I do hip work because chronic hip pain causes the gluteal muscles to be inhibited. So I have to teach my motor control system to keep the gluteals very high up in the priority. Yeah. I do a core workout every day, which is bird dog, side planks, front planks, perhaps a little stir the pot. And then I do a little bit of strengthening work. Some push and pulls, TRX work. I love kettlebell swings. However, with some of the injury history, my body can only tolerate certain amounts. And here's the thing. If I'm under the tipping point, it builds my body. But as soon as I cross it, I get those signals to say, back off, let your body adapt, and let the whole system detune. So I'm playing with those ones as well. And then I finish off each training session thinking, have I really served my body well? So a couple of days a week, I will do some extra mobility drills. I might do a little bit of thoracic extension. I train my feet to grip the floor well. Toes and heels, leaning tower exercises. I might do some not only calf raises, but also toe raises too, if you can imagine that. Mm. My legs don't tolerate a lot of load with my artificial hips and what knees I have left, but I walk backwards up a hill on my morning walks, and that is very tolerable and very athletically enhancing. I have to do a little bit of neck work just to keep it sufficiently stiff and stable, so it with the trauma that it has had over the years as well, just to keep the pain bogeyman at bay. So I've admitted a lot there that I don't normally discuss, but There you go. For my my hands are something else that I try and keep very athletic. And then again, I still like to roll with my athletes in the cage. I like to when we have a big lifter in, you know, I like to do a little bit of spotting. And then just to get through, say I'm putting on a performance training course and just working and demonstrating and cueing and whatnot, I need a certain amount of athleticism. So anyway, it's a bit of a long-winded answer, and it might have surprised you. I don't know.
We really, really appreciate the you sharing this space with us and all of the insight and advice you've given us and our listeners, Stu. We say thank you.
Well, you're most welcome. Stu. We can... do it again. I wish I had an outlet in Australia for my books. Unfortunately, they're on Amazon, and my Australian friends just tell me, well, they get together in groups and they order a bunch of stuff, and then there's only one shipping order. But isn't that a reality of Australia? There's really no other way to do it, is there?
Yeah. Is there like a PDF version that they can, a Kindle version that they can get as well?
No, there isn't. No, it's all hard copy.
Okay.
Before we... people find that they're more like manuals, and people like to get pens and make notes in the columns and all that kind of stuff, and that's really what I designed them for.
Yeah.
So we'll create the platform, and then when we have that set up, we'll let you know, and then we'll distribute for you.
Well, I hope that would be wonderful. I get orders. And requests, not every day, but several times a week, I could send you all kinds of orders. So let's set something like that up. That would be wonderful.
Sounds great.
Yeah, Stu, before you go, actually, you know, the more and more you talk, it resonates that you are a big fight fan. So just a fun question, who's your favorite UFC fighter?
I'm not allowed to say that. You'll notice that I never mention an athlete's name. However, if you Google my name, you will see me with all sorts of real top-end fighters. I'm going to say something else that you might find surprising.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult for me to watch now because every patient, every client, every athlete, they become a friend.
Yeah, of course.
And becomes very emotional, and I give them my heart and soul, and I think they give it back to me in return. And then it's like watching your son get hit.
Yeah, of course.
I can't stand it emotionally anymore. So I love my guys. I wish them all the best, and I just have to leave it at that. But no, I can't watch. Of course, I have favorites, but I cannot.
Apologies, Stu. The fire alarm has just gone off here, but we'll have all in the show notes. Online, obviously, you're at backfitpro.com. Facebook, you can find Stu, and YouTube at backfitpro, at backfitpro. So we'll have that all in the show notes for you, bud.
Okay, Tristan and Johnny, thank you so much.
That was awesome.
Absolute pleasure, mate.
Yeah, that was awesome. We'll be in touch.
Johnny, Stuart McGill, man.
Yeah, knowledge bombs, fire bombs, fire alarms. We had everything in that episode. And once again, part two is definitely a necessity. We just kind of, guys, you know, you just heard it. We just got to sit back, take notes, and enjoy the man.
Yeah, we've just been left with so much, you know. I just really want to listen to it right now because there was a lot. Do you know what I mean? And I think that people are going to have to listen to it again because there's just so much that we can execute right now. Do you know what I mean? We don't have to even do any more study. He's given us the answers right there.
Especially like having to leave the show and go coach, like the assessment advice, the algorithm, the equation of analyzing a client's walk and their gait, how to identify what success is in terms of specifically identifying their issues. All of these things in our industry, the fitness industry, the fitness game, they're overlooked because it's not required to be as specific as a doctor.
Yeah.
And I feel that as coaches, if I overlook things, I'm going to be held accountable, and it's kind of reckless to not dig deeper and research and study guys like Stu to become a better coach.
I think we both became a better coach on the spot. It's even things like that question I asked him about squat depth.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? We get into a mindset that our clients or ourselves, the deeper that we squat,
You're a big squatter.
You know, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You get in that mindset that we need to squat deep. Maybe we can't.
Did he say that? I want, like, the whole ass to grass thing. Like, why is that the fucking protocol for, like, a successful squat? And who came up with that?
Yeah, it's one of those things that we get. Maybe it's because of the way the technology and social media world that we're in now that we need to think that we need to prove that we need to ask to whatever it's called. What are they saying?
Ask to grass,
whatever it's called.
But like if you were...
But
if you were in a powerlifting competition,
There's a parallel. There's a line that you have to... I think it's...
Is it 90 degrees from hip to knee?
Hip to knee, yeah.
So like ankle, hip, knee, 90 degrees.
Which when you think about it, sitting in a chair, I'll probably squat deeper than that.
You definitely do.
Do I need to?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And what's like the law of diminishing returns? Like just because you can, isn't necessarily beneficial the older you get. Like is that going to have negative effects when you get older?
And just because I am, like you just mentioned, is it actually doing negative effects to me?
Yeah.
If I stop at that parallel, is that doing more for me?
Yeah. And like coming to a complete stop, are you using momentum the whole time? Is it good to stop in the hole and dig down? And then like the things he was saying about the NBA players, he said jumping off the heels. Like I wrote that down. I played ball my whole life. And I wonder if, I have to go back if he meant that. Like, is this something that I don't know? Are these guys jumping off the heel? I've always jumped, obviously, off the balls of the feet.
Because when you think about it, I know a lot of people run on their heels.
Yeah.
It is a common thing.
They run on their heels.
That it can happen. Like, I've got a flat foot. I think a lot of people just run off their toes or something.
Yeah, so if you look at a sprinter's shoe,
yeah,
there aren't any spikes on the heel. The spikes, like if you look at the bottom of it, the spikes are on the balls. Because the heel the heel has just a little bit of a padding because it's just part of the foot. It's not used to plant. Now, that's sprinting. I'm not sure about long distance.
Who knows? Because they jump from such a long distance, maybe they do need to plant their whole entire foot onto the ground. We'll have to watch some videos.
The things like about the compressed energy, like when we were talking about stretching and mobility, how mobility doesn't necessarily mean a good thing all the time. You have, you know, Kelly, who's an animal, man. We thank Dr. Kelly Surrett for being, one, you know, a companion of the show, but two, in the industry to push the industry along. But the danger in that idea is that some people will get attached to that as coaches and then think that that's the end all and be all with all of their clients and how they train everybody is you need maximal mobility on all joints. And, you know, all it takes is listening to a guy like Stu, and you could tell he disagreed with him on that. It was pretty awesome to hear his perspective, and then he gave us applicable examples of the athlete.
But it's thought-provoking.
Like, very thought-provoking.
I know that I've got a couple of clients that I have trained that have really tight hamstrings.
Yeah.
Maybe me trying to make them more and more mobile through that area is the wrong thing to be doing. But it gives me an approach to be looking into it a little bit more instead of trying to think back to what the masses say.
For sure. And then also, like, I have three clients. I'm going to leave here and go coach a couple clients, and now I'm going to look at them differently in terms of putting them in a category. Is this person a diver? Is this person a basketball player? Is this person a football player? And then figuring out, like, the tight hamstring issue, if we're squatting or deadlifting, empowering them to use that to their advantage rather than – how many of your clients think because they're not flexible, they think that it's a bad thing?
A lot.
And that's not true.
But it's going to make you a better coach today as well because you're going to have to get specific with three different people.
Yes.
So in terms of your own creativity, and he spoke about it when he answered my question about training through injuries, and he said the limitation usually isn't with the person that's injured. It's with a coach that isn't creative enough to come up with something.
Awesome, man, right?
And now you have to be creative because you know you've got three different people.
Yep.
So you can't give them three. You know, we all drift through it. I'm sure that every single coach in here has gone back to back with the same program before.
Oh, yeah. Like back to back to back.
Yeah, I see it all the time.
And all you're doing is changing the weights.
Yeah.
Yeah. Day in and day out.
But now it kind of gives you, in your top of your head, it's like, well, I can't do that.
The thing is, we have a choice now because what Dr. Stu just did was empower us and empower you guys listening at home. And that now from there, we can't say we didn't know. And I think that's a beautiful part about inquiring and having thought-provoking conversations like this. And researching is very important to where you can't just sit there. Like the coach you are today, the coach I am today compared to even 6 months ago, definitely not the same.
Oh, definitely not.
But who's to say if we never sat down a year and a half ago to start this passion of ours, if that would be the case? Because we are week in and week out putting ourselves in these conversations to to not turn our back.
Yeah.
We're putting ourselves face to face with experts who are helping us. And it's like, all right, are you going to evolve with us or are you going to just stay there and be static? And I think that's a beautiful part too of having like the media at our fingertips to learn because we all get to evolve.
Yeah. And I think it's important. I think we're both curious about different areas today, which is great because you can easily get stuck on the fence and not, you know, this is someone that is an expert in this field and not everyone has the opportunity to speak to him one-on-one. So I think it's a great learning experience for yourself and for myself. And I think we're going to be better coaches out of this for sure, man.
Yeah, for sure, man. This was awesome to share with you. This was awesome, man.
Yeah. We've got some great episodes ahead. Guys, next week we've got Tony Gaskins Jr. We've also got Chris Gilbo. So some great stories ahead. And we're just going to keep bringing – we're definitely going to get Stu back for part two.
For sure.
I think it's something that we definitely do need because I've got so much more that I think –
and maybe create a side hustle. All you guys listening at home, you heard that very tail end. If you have any ideas to help Tristan and I, email us if you want to get into our – book selling game.
Distributor.
We're going to be paper distributors.
Let's do it.
Be interesting. Yeah, man. Well, it's good content, isn't
it? For sure, dude. It's a good network as well.
All right, Johnny, before we go, social media stuff.
Yeah, guys, follow me, Johnny Stofko, on all socials. I'm really trying to get my YouTube channel kickstarted. I would really appreciate if you just go to YouTube and hit that red subscribe button. Other than that, keep following us. We'll keep bringing it. And the interactions with Tristan and I, that's what we love. So we say thank you.
Definitely, guys. So I'm Tristan Cannell Fitness on Instagram, maybe Twitter.
All them boys.
Facebook, I'm Tristan Cannell. Please add us and share it with your family and friends. Tag us in posts. We love the interaction. If you've got any guest requests or feedback from the show, info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. Me or Johnny will answer that. It's not a robot answering that. So we love it. So get in touch and we'll keep producing some great shows.
Yeah, and the opposite of that, I mean, it's from the bottom of my heart. For everyone who constantly messages us about, guys, you should interview this person, don't get pissed if we can't get them on or our books are always constantly like we look at this as chess months and months in advance. So yeah. Don't think that we're not like replying to that request. It's just that we're on this grind and hustle with you guys.
Sometimes Mike Tyson doesn't want to come on the show.
I heard that, baby. He coming though. They're gonna learn.
Johnny, DK. You have a great week, man, and we'll check you next week.
Too. Be good. All
right, peace.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast. Stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working hard at it. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.